Hey, everybody, it's Max here. Pat and I are super excited to bring back the Unintended Consequences podcast for a second run. And this time there is kind of a special occasion that has us bring the podcast back, which is Pat is working on this amazing game that I have played, and it's called TAC. Is it TAC or TOC, or how do you say it?
I say TAC.
TAC, okay. That's canonical. I play tested this thing when Veronica and I went up to Stevens Point, and we've actually been talking about it ever since.
We started off, and like right out of the gate, you're like, wall. And I'm like, and I was like, God damn it, Max, you know? Like, what the hell are you doing to my game? Like, it's not gonna handle this. And the game played out like totally different. I've been thinking of referring to that as like the Temkin maneuver.
Yeah, I'm into it. The Temkin gambit. Can I have a gambit?
Oh, gambit. The Temkin gambit. I like that.
It's almost as though, you know, what you and James have done is like reinvent something akin to like a chess or Go. It's like it feels like it's been around forever.
Yeah, one of the I've been following the comments and the reviews that people make. And one of the best reviews or comments that I've heard is people saying, it's amazing, like, how can no one have ever invented this game yet? You know, it's so simple, but it's so good. And, you know, in some ways, that's a little bit of a kick in the teeth to James, who, like, made this beautifully simple mechanic for the game. But in some ways, it's like the best compliment you could ever offer a designer to say, like, this game feels like it evolved naturally throughout the course of history. You know, and I'll honestly say, chess is probably the best comparison, but I will come out and say, it's like, I've played chess. I think this game is better than chess.
It really does have an elegance, and I think one of the other things I really admire about the game is just from what I've seen on the Kickstarter, like the production value of this thing just looks absolutely insane. Like, I think you guys are really, you know, I think you guys have made a promise of the fantasy of this game of like, oh, it's going to be like this old game that's played in the tavern, and you've really delivered on that promise for people.
Yeah, it's, you know, I never want to make something for the readers of my book that ends up being kind of like a cheap plastic piece of crap that they buy because they love my books, and then it sits on a shelf, you know, or they throw it away when they move because they're like, ugh, you know, why did I buy in for that? So, you know, it is, we're working to like really make it beautiful. There's one of the upgraded boards, is all the pieces are going to be wooden. But one of the upgraded boards, I don't know if we had it when we played you and me, Max, but we found somebody here, like it literally one of my neighbors out in the country, out of my apocalypse land. You know, his name is Welling, and so through the Welling Woodworks, he made this board, and it's great. And putting the wooden pieces on a wooden board, I'm not saying it's better than sex, but it is on the same spectrum as sex a little bit, you know?
Well, what's that, Pat? You're breaking up a little bit. Well, anyway, if people are interested in learning more about TAC, TOC, however you want to say it, where would they go if you could tell us?
But the Kickstarter itself, if you just search, you know, Kickstarter and TAK and Rothfuss, I mean, that'll get you where you're going no matter what search engine you use. I've written about it on the blog too a couple of times. So yeah, you can find it either one of those places. Oh no, are you verklempt?
No, just clearing the throat. Just getting ready. Ready for some talking. Can I describe to our listeners what I see in the video right now? So Pat called me and you got the video on Skype there, and I'm seeing. So let me just go. I don't even know where to start. Let me just kind of work top to bottom on the shelves here. So I think on the top, what I'm looking at is alternate language versions of Name of the Wind, which are very cool. I've sort of seen some of your collection of that. And then just a huge line of the demented owl bears, which I think was that World Builder swag?
It was. We did it for a convention. John Kovalik helped us design that plushie, and then we sold them for World Builders.
It's just like one. So basically, how do I describe it? They're these sort of chubby plush owl bears, and they have these huge googly eyes that are all like catawampus, and one of them would be funny, but there's 10 of them all lined up on the shelf behind you, just staring at you, confused. And then some sort of Buffy the Vampire Slayer and Angel paraphernalia that I don't recognize, and then just some of your million lineal feet of books.
When I started streaming on this computer, we put a bunch of the prizes for World Builders, like the books people had donated, up on those shelves. And then we gave all those books away because that's what those books were for. And so it was just like bare wall and empty shelves behind me. So I defaulted to the owlbear plushies. I think I might move all the foreign language editions behind me. Just because if I'm going to have a vanity wall, it might as well be behind me every time I Skype.
Well, for people who are, because we're kind of bringing back this podcast for a second run. So for people who might not be familiar with us, maybe we should take a minute and sort of just introduce ourselves and talk about what the podcast is for a second.
Okay.
So my name is Patrick Rothfuss. I'm a New York Times bestselling author. I've written 2.5 books. And I know all of the secrets of Doors of Stone, but I selfishly will not tell people what happens.
My name is Max Temkin. I am one of the minds behind Cards Against Humanity. I do a lot of charity work and am a very active participant in Chicago's comedy and indie theater scene.
Oh, wow. Yours was a lot nicer. I feel like such a piece of shit now. Yours was... You really killed me with kindness there.
Oh, yeah. If I can't get you from the front, I'll get you from the back.
You know what I was thinking about the other day? Because I was getting excited to talk to you. I thought maybe people would like this whole story of when we were at PAX a few weeks ago. And we were walking around Boston. We were with a bunch of friends. We were with Paul and Storm and the Magic Tavern folks. And we were like looking around trying to get a drink after the show. And for people who aren't from Boston or haven't traveled there a lot, like Boston is, it's a weird city in a lot of ways. But one of the ways that it's the weirdest is that it completely shuts down after, even on a weekend, after, I don't know, like 10, 11 o'clock, which is like, I'm not like a big night, I'm not like out doing stuff at night, but you're out at a convention and like in a major American city, you'd expect there to be like stuff to do. So we wound up walking approximately 50 miles to get to a bar that was open. And we get to the bar and it was like the most surreal scene. It was nearly completely empty inside. There were just a few tables of people sitting drinking, but there was like I think they were short staffed, and there was a bouncer outside, and he's like, oh, we're not, and we showed up and we're like, can we get a table? And he was like, we're not letting more people in. And you went up to the guy to try and schmooze him, I think. What was your strategy?
Mine was, I'm good at very few things, but persuading people is one of them. And I saw him let one person in, mm-hmm. and that, at first I thought that they were just closing down, and so they weren't letting new customers in. But then I realized what he didn't want is like a dozen drunk, assholes coming in and chaosing up his freaking bar. So I'm like, I just need to tell him that we are like, we're looking for a place to sit and we're going to order some drinks and we're going to tip well, and we're not going to wreck up the joint or be obnoxious and wreck everyone's day. So that was just my strategy.
And then I think I went to, as he was telling you that he still couldn't let us in, I went up to him and I was like, do you have any idea who this is? This is best-selling author Patrick Rothfuss. And if you let us into this bar, he'll tell you one major spoiler for Doors of Stone. And he just looked at us like, the fuck are you talking about?
Yep.
I was like, someone's never heard of your books. And, I thought I got you. And then we sit down and someone from the kitchen comes out and they're like, oh, Mr. Rothfuss, I'm a huge fan. I brought you a drink. So,
yeah, Yeah, it's never when I expect it. But yeah, it's still a little odd to get recognized in public, let alone to get recognized and like somebody. I actually spotted him on Twitter first because he went like, "Holy shit, Pat Rothfuss is in my bar." I'm like looking around. I'm like, "Oh God, which one is he?" And then somebody sent me a drink, and I'm like, "Okay, that's cool, but." You know, I have a reciprocity thing because I'm from the Midwest. I have trouble just taking something from someone. But he came out and it was cool and we chatted a little bit.
So let's see. What else? I also wanted to just quickly introduce the podcast. So this podcast that people are listening to, if you're new to the podcast, this is a great episode to start on. Basically the idea is we do a run of 10 episodes and Pat and I just have sort of a call every week, and we talk about work, and we talk about our lives. And last time, we sort of had this theme of sort of setting self-improvement goals, and you know, small little things like not checking our phone right away when we woke up, and you know, just sort of experimenting and seeing how that affected our life. And I'm hoping to continue that with this run and come up with little challenges for ourselves.
Yeah, I still like one of your proposed names from the beginning. Which was white guys talking.
It's true. I feel like we're filling a big hole in the podcast market where it's two white guys talking about. Well, and the thing here's what's special about us, Pat, is that we're not really especially qualified. But does that stop us from having opinions? No, it does not.
No. We that's really something that's lacking in the male white affluent, you know, community is. Underinformed people with strong opinions. And so we really felt a social need to step up. Oh God, Max, we should call the podcast "Well Actually." I dare you, Max. We gotta rename the podcast "Well Actually."
Oh God. It's just so insufferable. It's like I feel like if you listen to that podcast, like I don't even know. I feel like we'd just be like trying to explain like the Marvel Cinematic Universe to each other. Like, well, actually, the Hulk wasn't always green.
Did I tell you out at PAX what my brilliant charity idea was? It would be effectively, instead of, it used to be like you would at the county fair or whatever, you'd have a kissing booth, right?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it would raise money for whatever, you know, I don't know, the school or whatever people raised money for back when you had county fairs. And you know, little Timmy's gammy leg, I don't know. And so what this would be is it would be at a con, except it would be an information booth. But it wouldn't just be like information. It would be information, ? And we would put like an attractive young woman behind it, and she would say things like, "So why can't we have a movie where Wolverine fights Batman?" You know, and like she would throw out these questions, and guys would be drawn in to like mansplain to her.
Oh, I like it.
But for every minute, right, you have to pay $1. And every time you use the word "actually," you have to pay $1.
Here we go. Let me take it and turn it. How about this? Because you know, Pat, I'm a big fan of the upsell, right? It's like, you know, the free to play app, right?
Uh-huh.
You get people to download the app because they think they're getting in, they're getting this free game, and then pow, you got to buy a lot of coins. You got to get the gold for $2.99. Here's my proposal, right?
Okay.
$1. So same premise, right? You got your little booth, right? A woman sits behind the booth, and there's just a sign on front that says $1. I explain something to you. $100, oh, right. You explain something to me.
Oh my God, that's way better.
Yeah.
Oh, that's way better.
And here's the thing, because this is what's brilliant about it. Lots of people are going to be suckered in and they're going to say, oh, $1, I'm going to listen to this woman explain something to me. But by the end, they're paying $100. Right. You know what I mean?
Right.
Like it's basically an endurance test of like how long can you go before you're like, well, actually the ice cubes in the cocktail are round because it does something with the surface. I didn't even know that one.
As soon as I kind of pitched this idea to my friends, you know, one of my friends is an actual particle physicist, you know, like gets the deep science. And he's like, oh, he goes, I could go in there and he goes, and I could let people, you know, I could let people explain to me or, you know, why faster than light travel can exist, you know, and and then as soon as we started talking about it, because apparently as soon as he mentions he's a physicist, people are like, so, right? Faster than light travel. He's like, oh God, you know, not again.
The worst is when people try to explain to physicists their sort of fan theories of, you know how, okay, you know when people come to you and they've read your books and they come up with like headcanon where they're like, well, actually I have this whole side theory of like this fiction that's not really supported in the text, but it's like, it's their own little fantasy of how it works. Lots of people have that with quantum entanglement. That seems to be the physics thing where everyone has some theory of how you're going to defeat the speed of light with quantum entanglement. They don't quite understand how quantum entanglement works.
Well, quantum entanglement is pretty much sympathy, you know.
Okay.
Boy, that actually got you a little bit.
I think I can explain. So I have Josh from Cards has a PhD in astrophysics, and I'm pretty sure it's from Josh gave me the one explanation of quantum entanglement that actually made me understand it. Okay. So you basically know the idea of like it's like the way. I'll tell you the popular misconception, and then I'll tell you how Josh explained it to me. So the popular misconception is that, and here we go. I'm explaining something that I don't really understand. Buckle up. Basically, the popular conception is like you have these two particles, and they're quantum entangled, and if you change one, the other one changes. So, and instantaneously across space and time, it seemingly. So basically, people have this fantasy of like, well, what if you sent one particle to another galaxy and you kept one here? You could use them to communicate in like Morse code, right? By like flipping it back and forth and the other one would respond. Does not work that way. Here's how it works. Let's say that I had two balls, a black ping pong ball and like a white ping pong ball, and I blindly put them into two canvas bags, right? So one ball is sealed in one bag, one ball is sealed in the other bag. So you and I have no idea which bag each, and we each have one bag, we have no idea which ball is in each of our bags, right? If I, now I fly in a spaceship to the moon with my ball. If I'm standing on the surface of the moon and I open up my bag and I see the white ball, I instantly know that your ball must be black. But you haven't communicated. No rules of physics have been broken, right? I didn't observe your ball. There wasn't any faster than light communication. It's just that looking at the one thing gave me information about the other thing.
That's interesting. I've heard it described differently. I always think of, you know, quantum entanglement as should I lead this off well actually?
Yeah, I think we have to.
Okay. Well, actually, I
I got a little chill down my spine.
Me too. It felt good and it felt bad at the same time. It was sort of like, yeah, like dirty, but like good dirty. I don't know.
It's how I imagine Donald Trump voters must feel every time they hear him talk.
I imagine it's how Donald Trump must feel every waking moment of his life. You know how a dog must feel when it rolls in its own filth?
Mm-hmm.
I feel like that is just how Donald Trump feels all the time. He doesn't have to roll in anything. He is his own self-generating filth. Wow. Maybe we shouldn't put that in the podcast, Max. Maybe that's a little.
You think that's a hot take? You think a lot of our listeners are going to be like, I don't know, Donald Trump. That's a bold stance. They don't like him. The only thing is that Donald Trump is like Voldemort. It's like any time you say his name, he just becomes more powerful. And it doesn't matter what you're saying, right? It's like he's now profiting off of us making fun of him on this podcast. It doesn't matter whether we're saying he rolls around in his own shit or not. It just matters that we said his name.
Yeah. Well, and that's a real good point. The other thing is, you know, it feels, you know, for like if you go after like Obama and you say, boy, you know, he's so dumb, you know, he doesn't understand the foreign policy. He doesn't understand the underlying blah, blah, blah of Pakistan and the national tensions that are created by blah, blah, blah. You could actually sort of like, you can kind of shit talk him, you know, but and either have a true statement about his knowledge or lack of knowledge, or a false statement about his knowledge or lack of knowledge. Whereas Trump, like, to try to criticize a policy that is utter nonsense, it's like you can't engage critically in something which is by its very nature non-critical.
I see. So it's basically what – I mean, essentially, if I understand it, what you're saying is like whether you agree or disagree, but Obama at least has policies, and you can – he says things that are related to fact and that they're falsifiable and that you can have a debate about the merits of his views. And Trump is like – he says farcical things like we're going to build a wall and make the Mexicans pay for it, or we're going to do worse than waterboarding and commit war crimes and torture people. And everybody is free to laugh it off and be like, oh, well, he doesn't really mean that.
Well, no, I think what it is people are trying to engage with what he says using the same critical tools we've always used for engaging in political commentary. But like, you know, and this happens with Sarah sometimes with my kids, is she'll get into an argument with them. Now, discussing things with a kid is very valuable because then they understand that there are reasons why they can't eat sugar just all day. They understand that, you know, mom or dad isn't just being an ogre and imposing, you know, their will on you. But at the same time, as soon as you enter into an argument with a child, you have lost, because, you know, they will be, you know, they'll go, you, they'll say, you'll say, it's time for bed. And they say, I am going to stay up. And you say, no, actually it's important because we need to go to school in the morning, and then you will be crabby all day. So there's your reason. You're giving them facts, and that's useful. And then they go, nuh-uh. And then if you try to continue to have a rational argument with them, you can't, because they're not playing by rational rules. And so when Trump says, you know, we're going to build a wall and make Mexico pay for it, it's sort of like a kid saying, you know, why not, you know, I'm going to build a rocket and go to the moon. To sit down and say, okay, so explain to me like how your rocket will really get funding, Timmy. You know, it's a
lot of community bake sales.
Right. It's trying to engage rationally with a person who, by their very argument, has shown that rationality is not a part of their modus. And so in one way, you're absolutely right, where, you know, just talking about him, you know, you can't take credibility away from somebody who is nonsensical. So all the engagement of the rational process does is lend him a semblance of credibility, because you're trying to put what he says into a rational framework.
Right. So like Trump's whole thing is, if I understand you correctly, Trump's whole thing is like, well, I'm not a politician. I'm sort of outside of this whole thing, and I'm you know, I might be fucking crazy, but I'm different than everyone else, and I'm going to be my authentic self, and we're, you know, just go for it. And everyone else is like, wow, why haven't you released your tax returns, and why don't your policies make sense? And Trump is like, exactly.
yeah, it's, well, and you know, he kind of does play that no matter what happens, I win game.
Right.
You know, where it's like, people are like, so we ran the math, and you know, within 8 months, your policy would destroy the global economy, and he's like, ha ha, just like I planned.
My favorite part is where he says he would continue to borrow aggressively, and then if the economy tanks, he would make a tremendous deal with our creditors.
Right, I read about that. You know, he's thinking. Again, it's – and there you go. There's the fallacy of analogy, where analogies, as I can attest to, are amazingly useful in terms of communicating a base level understanding of an alien and or complex concept, which is just what you did in terms of quantum entanglement. However, if you take the analogy to be similar to the thing itself – or like truly the same as the thing itself, he's making a business analogy, you know, and taking and just assuming it's true, because sometimes a business does go bankrupt, and it can be very useful for a business to go bankrupt, as he knows he's been through what, six of them?
Right. But this is where the metaphor falls apart, because the United States government is not a business.
And yes. It
talk about too big to fail. Like, the sanctity of U.S. debt is the bedrock of the global economy. So if people no longer have faith in like the credit of the United States government and treasury, like, I mean, it really could be some like, you know that Albert Einstein thing, like, I don't know with what weapons World War III will be fought, but World War IV will be fought with sticks and stones. That's like some sticks and stones shit to me.
It really is. It's, you know, what he proposed, just like, and I'm not an economist, okay? I'm going to come right out and say this, but I've actually read a lot of economic theory.
Well, actually.
Well, actually, you know.
Sam, it really is a good name for our podcast.
We really should. We should consider that. Yeah. It's at least it shows a level of self-awareness, and it can help shine a light on, you know, the problem of, you know, and we're a little safe. This would really be awful if one of us was, you know, a woman. Then, you know, we can well actually to each other, because we're at a similar, you know, social power level, you know. Mm-hmm. I forgot what I was talking about.
Sorry. You're not an economist, but actually we're talking about the debt. Oh, US Treasury debt. Yeah,
right. The economy, you know, because I've read up a lot about it, you know, the economy of France collapsed because of the way that they treated money and how they screwed it up. You know, this happened like all over throughout Europe as they transitioned away from like a gold standard, or, you know, effectively, you know, money as non-representational currency. This is something I've done research into, one, because it's fascinating, two, because I'm a geek for currency and coins and those sort of things. But, you know, even with my like very base level knowledge of how money works and the global economy, I heard that and I went, like, that is the economic equivalent of just kind of like setting off a bunch of nukes to kind of just to prove a point. Right. You know, it's like the best thing that will happen is it will poison the earth for 1,000 years. and that's the best case. You know, it's like the worst case is like sticks and stones.
I was hoping not to go down this whole rabbit hole on literally the first episode of our podcast, but I have a bad feeling about Trump. Not in the way of not that it's like I disagree with him or whatever. I have actual anxiety about Trump, and I've had like a couple of Donald Trump nightmares in the last couple of weeks. Like I see a scenario where he just beats Hillary, and you know, the Democrats are not excited and they don't show up, and Trump manages to build this crazy coalition, and, you know, America is like just dumb enough to elect this like fascist demagogue, and it just makes me feel like, I don't know, like I felt this when I worked on the Obama campaign in 2008. I felt this kind of hope about American politics, where, you know, I always had this version of America that I wanted to believe I was living in, the kind, you know, the America that would elect a black president, right? And then it's like, is it going to happen? And then it happens, and it's this like hope and this relief and this like, wow, like this country is awesome and I'm really excited to be a part of this time and place. Whatever the exact opposite of that is, that's how I feel about Donald Trump, of like my worst fears of what America is.
You know, I think about a lot about teaching, and I talk to people who are teachers. If somebody comes through my signing line, you know, or if I run into somebody at a con, there's two types of people that I will stop and talk to for, you know, for a goodly piece of time. And one of those is like new parents or like a pregnant mom. And I'll say, you know, do you want to talk about kids? You're about to embark on a really amazing thing. You know, I've learned some cool information. Would you like a quick, you know, pamphlet version of that? And I'll take a couple of minutes to talk to new parents. The other ones I talk to are people who mentioned that they're new teachers. And because I was a teacher, and I suck as a scholar or an academic of any sort, but I am a good teacher. And so I would talk to them, but the core of my pedagogy and the core of any advice I give to an up-and-coming teacher, somebody who wants to be a teacher, is that whatever you do, you need to be earnest with your students. You know, with me, I went into the classroom and I look kind of like a slobby hobo and I cuss and I'm really not impressive in any traditional academic way. But the key is that I don't pretend to be. And because I'm not pretending to be something that I'm not, these students who have been lied to like every minute of their lives since, you know, since they were four and could recognize it, they've had all manner of fakeness forced on them in the media, and they've had all manner of polite social lies shoveled onto them. And they've had teacher after teacher that like plasters on a fake smile and pretends to be enthusiastic about, you know, teaching Robert Frost to fifth graders. You know, and I go in and sometimes I'm like, guys, I did not get enough sleep last night. I'm feeling like just twice baked ass today. You're not going to get an A+ lecture out of me. I'm just going to tell you that right from the beginning. And they're like, okay, let's go. And then we move on from there, you know, because they can see that I look ragged. But they respond to honesty, because honesty is such a rare commodity these days. I think, you know, Trump's rise to power is he's honest about what he is, and that's so rare, especially in politics. I mean, forget teaching. You know, earnestness in politics isn't just a rare commodity. It's like a freaking unicorn.
Right.
And so he comes out and he's like, guess what? I'm a narcissist, a megalomaniac, a racist, and an asshole. And everyone's like, wow, how refreshing. And
right.
I think it's absolutely the same mechanism that draws people to Bernie. And you know, it's like people find the fact that he isn't playing this sort of game super refreshing. And you know, Hillary, you know, I have a little story. I was on an airplane. I can't even remember where I was going, but I sat next to this guy. We're both leaving from Wisconsin. Talked a little bit about, he was like, oh, what do you do? What do you do? You know, he works with the FDA, and I mentioned that I'm involved in some food-related charity, and we talk about that. And at one point I say, well, you know, obviously I'm a bleeding heart liberal. He's like, oh, yeah. He goes, I get that. I am too. And then at some point in the conversation, he goes, there's a pause, and he goes, so I'm guessing you're for Bernie? And I'm like, yeah. I go, honestly, I love Bernie. I love his honesty and pretty much everything he says I agree with. And I said, you? And he goes, I'm Hillary. And I'm like, oh, that's cool. You know, it's like, I'm like, I'd vote for Hillary. And he goes, yeah. He goes, I'd vote for Bernie. And then we just move on. And that, honestly, I think is the state of like 99% of all like human beings in the US who are Democrats. They're like, you know, I like my person and I might have a thing or two against your person, but like, you know, we're kind of all on the same team. I genuinely feel that most people feel that way. And then there are a few statistically anomalous and unnormally loud assholes on the internet that seem to make the divisiveness seem much more prevalent than it really is.
Yeah, I think so. I'm actually a little suspicious of the equivalency of Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump. So I think there's an analogy there of you have the rise of these two populist candidates on the far left and the far right. But I'm also suspicious of the sort of like both sidism of like, oh, well, it's important. You know, you get this in the media where it's like, if you're going to have someone on to talk about climate change, you also need to have a climate change denier on to provide balance, right?
I will say I'm certainly not saying there's anything really like equivalency, but I do think there's a similar factor in play on both of those sides.
Yeah, and it's a, you know, I mean, on both sides, there's a broad dissatisfaction with the political process, which is clearly not working, right? Like, it's obvious if you watch the news that the political, the American political process is not at having its best moment right now. So I think on the left, there, you know, I think the right, honestly, I think they are tired of losing national elections and they're angry and they see the composition of the country changing. And, you know, obviously white people are losing influence both economically and culturally and demographically in America, and that really scares some people. And I think on the left, I think one of the legacies of the initial sort of Obama campaign was that there was this message of like hope and change. And what was interesting about that is that it was a big tent message that allowed everyone to put their beliefs into this one guy. But there was a downside of that too, which we definitely people recognized inside of the campaign, you know, by the time it ended, which was that everybody put these incredibly unrealistic expectations on Obama because he had opened himself up to be everything that everyone wanted him to be. And there's so many people in America, you simply can't be that.
Right.
So who is Obama really? He's a pragmatist. He's a deal maker. He's a centrist. He is all about 1% is better than nothing, right? Would he rather have 100%? Yes, but you never get 100% in politics. That's the nature of the job. So he's like, let's take 1% and call and be happy that we did 1%. And then tomorrow we'll do another 1%. And for some people on the left, and even at, you know, at times myself, I'm not happy with a 1% gain, right? I feel like, well, there was this national mandate and this guy got elected twice and by, you know, overwhelmingly. And where's the 100%? I want my, you know, single payer socialist healthcare, and I want to draw down the military, right, and stop putting so much money into weapons manufacturing and all of that. So it's like, well, where's my like big liberal victories? And I think there's some anger on the left too. But I think at least Sanders is like engaging. I think he at least is putting himself. I think the main difference is, you know, he's at least intellectually putting himself out there in that he has like policies and he's for and against things. And he's earnest. Like, there's a refreshing, like, earnesty to Bernie Sanders of he's like, yep, I'm a socialist. Here's what I'm about. And, you know, you can decide whether I'm crazy or not. I personally feel like he's a little bit crazy. But, you know, with Trump, like, the thing that scares me is I think Trump is, like, the ironic candidate. I think he's, like, the troll candidate of, like, he, yeah. Like, everything he says is smirking. And it's like, well, if he goes too far, it's like, oh, well, I was just playing a character, right? It's like I only ironically believed in that. I didn't really believe in that. And I was thinking about there's this great David Foster Wallace essay from, I think, like, the late 90s called E Unibus Plurum. And it's about he is writing about the. I'm actually very curious to get your thoughts on this because the essay is about what television. Because this is pre-internet, but he's saying what has television, the rise of everybody watching television all the time. What has that done to novelists? Like, where is the literary scene post the rise of television? So he talks about that television is all about the sort of like ironic appreciation of things and that people know they're being advertised to. So advertising as the point he's writing this essay, advertising in the 90s had become very self-referential, making fun of self-aware of being an ad and making fun of being an ad. And that for a certain kind of literature, which is a more earnest kind of literature, that this was like a really toxic environment to be earnestly talking about ideas because people come to it with a TV mentality, and they're looking for this like ironic detachment. So he said, anyone with the heretical gall to ask an ironist what he actually stands for ends up looking like a hysteric or a prig. And herein lies the oppressiveness of institutionalized irony, the too successful rebel. The ability to interdict the question without attending to its subject is, when exercised, tyranny. It uses the very tool that exposed its enemy to insulate itself. And yeah. I was rereading that essay and I came across that and it just stunned me. I was like, oh my God, Donald Trump. I do get this feeling watching him of he's a tyrant, he's a bully, he's a dictator, and he's taken this arch, cynical, post-ironic anger of the internet, you know, that we see in, you know, I at least I read this into Gamergate, and you see this in all the different sort of right-wing movements on the internet, this, like, irony of, like, well, we're going to have these extreme views, but protect ourselves with an ironic distance. And he uses it as a tyrant, right? Because anything you say about him, it doesn't stick.
Well, I think I actually recognized it. I actually recognized it with Bush. And not exactly this, but something a little similar, where in the public view, at least from the Democratic side, Bush, the W was a bumpkin, you know, mm-hmm. like he was a bumpkin, and he was dumb, and he would say these things, and at a certain point, I went, wait. If you dismiss someone as an idiot and then they do something and then you try to, and then you say your immediate psychological reaction is to go, well, shit, they don't know any better. And I think because of that, and whether Bush's like sort of public persona on that side where he was playing a little bit of that bumpkin, to a good political effect, you know, or at least like the big front facing Bush, you know, as kind of the bumpkin, kind of this bumbler, kind of this misspeaker, you know, because if you're trying to again engage with a person like that rationally or engage with their policy rationally, you kind of can't, because you've already said, well, they're an idiot, and then you're like, so let's look exactly at their actions and their motivations, and you're like, actually you can't do that if you've already dismissed them as an idiot. All you can do is go, oh well, I guess, you know, they even did that little sitcom called That's My Bush.
That's right.
And it's like, that was the catchphrase. It's like, and he would do something and everyone would go, that's my Bush, where you can't criticize somebody that is not capable of making criticizable choices, in the same way that I can't be super critical of my 2-year-old for doing something. You can't be critical of a politician who you genuinely believe to either be an idiot, like a lot of people believed Bush to be, or somebody who has like quantifiable and clinical mental disorders, like Trump. And I'm actually not funning around or engaging in hyperbole there. Like, a coalition of psychologists have come out and said, this man is a textbook narcissist.
Right.
And that's like narcissism, if you don't know what it really is. Psychologists have something that they refer to as the dark triad, and it's Machiavellianism, narcissism, and I think it's either sociopathy or megalomania. I can't remember what that third one is exactly, but there is pretty much, if you get all three of those, it's like, it's the hat trick.
Can you say what those are?
And actually, let me.
I'm just looking it up. It's narcissism, Machiavellianism, and psychopathy.
To the internet.
Well, actually.
I'm screwing it up. Narcissism.
You want to hear my Obama quote about irony that I caught? This was like the same day I read that David Foster Wallace thing. There was an interview in the New York Times where it was like a conversation between Bryan Cranston from Breaking Bad and Barack Obama. And Barack Obama said, he says, I say these things, he's talking about his political message. He says, I say these things to kids because I'm trying to inoculate them against cynicism, which is a powerful force in our culture. It's what passes for wisdom, being ironic and cynical.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's true. Like, sarcasm is, you know, sarcasm or dismissiveness is, in our culture, it's viewed as being very, it's viewed as almost parallel to intelligence. You know, we're talking down about things or being like, oh, that'll never work. It's viewed as wisdom.
In Dante's Inferno, I think it's the fifth circle of hell is for wrath, and there's two people who go to the wrath circle, which is so, and they're both related to rage. So wrath is rage expressed, and if you have rage that is unexpressed, that's aloofness. And people who are aloof also wind up in the wrath circle, where they have to watch people fight forever and act ironically detached.
Oh, that's funny.
Yeah.
Okay, so I've gone to the internet, which is, of course, the source of all knowledge and true things. Narcissistic personality disorder. It's characterized by exaggerated feelings of self-importance, an excessive need for admiration, and a lack of empathy for others. And so anybody who's heard me talk at any length of time, personally, I feel like empathy is the defining human characteristic. And so this particular personality disorder, which is characterized by a lack of empathy, is, you know, this is one of the reasons they refer to this as one of the parts of the dark triad. People with this disorder often come across as arrogant, callous, envious, tend to be exploitative of others. They can be excessively preoccupied with personal adequacy, power, prestige, vanity, and the size of their hands. Here we go. I brought up megalomania before. It says here that narcissistic personality disorder was historically called megalomania. So that explains my little bit of confusion there. Narcissism, it actually sounds kind of nice. I mean, narcissi is a flower. It has this Greek root. You know, Narcissus was, again, the whole story comes from one of these Greek myths. But like truly narcissistic people are like, you know, they move through the world. My analogy response is failing me. They're radioactive. They move through the world, and everything they come in contact with quite frequently ends up poisoned or ruined because they are so self-centered. They will just use up people and kind of spew chaos and bad things into the world. Hmm. But again, you know, I hesitate to do a big unpack. You can find a link to those articles. When I say a coalition of psychologists, there's like literally hundreds of them got together and said, we are making a joint statement. We have examined hundreds of hours of footage of him speaking both before the campaign and during the campaign. And here are all of the clear indicators of somebody with narcissistic personality disorder.
Well, I'm going to put all of the links to the Dark Triad and the New York Times article with Barack Obama and Bryan Cranston, all these things we've been talking about in the show notes for this episode, which are available at unattendedconsequences.com. Let me see I had one more thing from this David Foster Wallace article I thought you might like. So this is the kind of takeaway quote that gets quoted from this essay all the time. But he's talking about, you know, again, his concern is just within literature. So he's like, how does literature respond to this kind of cynicism and irony and darkness in the culture, where it's like you get made fun of for sort of like earnestly doing the job of literature, which is it's interesting that you mentioned like empathy is the most human characteristic, because I think I think David Foster Wallace and a lot of the authors I've talked about, they talk about literature as like an empathy simulator, or like an empathy exercise. It's like exercising those muscles of like these stories and these characters that are not like yourself, that you can feel for and experience through their eyes.
They've actually done studies, and these is like, it's fascinating to feel vindicated in my personal belief, to show that people who read more actually like quantifiably and statistically have higher degrees of empathy. They looked at a bunch of different factors, like how can we instill empathy? How can we encourage empathy or teach empathy? And the only thing that consistently shows results is the amount that people read effectively novels. It's not just reading, because in text you have the opportunity to engage in someone else's thought process in a way that other medium don't provide. You know, like, you know, you don't get the narrative layover in television the way that you get it in text. That some of those studies have just come out, I think, within this last year.
Like you said, like, that lines up so perfectly with my beliefs about reading and, like, what I feel like I get out of reading. And, like, I think the interesting – so, like, and this David Foster Wallace essay is interesting because, like, he's kind of going through some of the different phases of literature, and he's been like, well, there's always been, you know, rebellious sort of revolutionary literature that pushed the boundaries of the time. And usually what they would do is they would strip away one taboo after another. So it's like, oh, this thing that we're not – that's not okay to talk about, we're going to talk about it, and we're going to shock people and surprise them, and we're going to be the ones that are out there. And now we're living in a time where we're post that, right? There is no taboo that, like, literature can't comment on. And so he's like, well, where do you go from here in an age where everybody is cynical and everybody is ironic? Like, what can you – how do you have literature that surprises people and is lively and relevant? So he says – the next real literary rebels in this country might well emerge as some weird bunch of anti-rebels, born oglers who dare somehow to back away from ironic watching, who have the childish gall actually to endorse and instigate single entendre principles, who treat plain old untrendy human troubles and emotions in U.S. life with reverence and conviction, who eschew self-consciousness and hip fatigue. These anti-rebels would be outdated, of course, before they even started. Dead on the page, too sincere, clearly repressed, backwards, quaint, naive, anachronistic. Maybe that'll be the point. Maybe that's why they'll be the next rebels. Real rebels, as far as I can see, risk disapproval. The old postmodern insurgents risked the gasp and the squeal, shock, disgust, outrage, censorship, accusations of socialism, anarchism, nihilism. Today's risks are different. The new rebels might be artists willing to risk the yawn, the rolled eyes, the cool smile, the nudged ribs, the parody of gifted ironists, the, oh, how banal. To risk accusations of sentimentality, melodrama, of overcredulity, of softness, of willingness to be suckered by a world of lurkers and starers who fear gaze and ridicule above imprisonment without law. Who knows?
I thought about that a while back because, you know, things are satirized, or rather, things can be satirized almost in direct proportion to their sincerity. There's some things that are, it's sort of like, and I'm dating myself here, but Torchwood, you know, the Doctor Who spinoff, mm-hmm. Where, like, everybody was sexing everybody else, which was honestly, it was pretty cool and pretty socially progressive. But people described it as fanfic proof. Because, like, you couldn't ship anybody in the series who wasn't already, like, doing it, you mm-hmm. know? And, you know, similarly, if, you know, if you write a story or you write a song or if you engage in an act of creation, or, like, artistic creation, and what is... let me say that again. If you engage in an act of artistic creation, which is ironic, you're sort of satire proof and you're criticism proof. But at the same time, you're also not engaging in a sincere statement of anything. It's kind of a cowardly sort of creation. And, you know, honestly, I think even as I was writing the Name of the Wind, I thought of really funny ways to satire it because it kind of reeked of sincerity in places. I really was trying to write, you know, a true story, something with some sort of meat or merit to it. And because of that, you know, it's ripe for mockery. It's just like Batman. Batman is utterly sincere, and there is no character that is easier to fucking make fun of because he's so intense all the time, and he's begging for satire, because, you know, Batman is the ultimate unironic everything. So we should talk about something stupid and fun, right? To leaven this episode.
I don't know. There's a flip side to the coin of, like, if the tyranny and the there's this sort of oppression that comes with this extreme cynicism of, like, well, I have no position, so you can't critique me. I wonder if there's, like, it does make me feel like maybe there's some sort of liberation in just saying, well, here's what I believe.
Yeah, and I think honestly it's coming to that more and more. I think, you know, the fact that I go into a classroom and I say, you were expecting somebody maybe in a tweedy jacket with patches on the elbows, probably speaking in some manner of English accent, who's going to teach you about English. But, like, I ain't that. Let's take it in this other direction. You know, I did it at first kind of because, I don't know, because I was lazy and this is how I normally look. And I've kind of given up looking like anything else at this point in my life. But as I progressed as a teacher and as I thought about it more and more, I realized part of the reason I was doing it is so that people, you know, rather than play into their expectations and try to use their expectations to get my job done, I actually viewed my real job, my overarching job as kind of a human being and an educator, was to go in and say, look at this big, beardy, crass, hobo-looking motherfucker. You know, is going to teach you about the fucking beauty of language, whether you want to learn it or not. You know, I'm going to talk to you about narrative structure. I'm going to tell you the truth of the world. And if you think that you can only learn things from tidy looking British accent academic people, it's like you are woefully mistaken, and you absolutely need to learn that mistake now. Like, when you're still on the cusp of adulthood, when your brain is still soft enough to adjust its expectations, you know, because if you fall into that trap, it's the same trap that makes people, like, not, you know, want to listen to women when they're talking about anything. It's the same thing that makes people, you know, like, the more attractive somebody is, the more you want to dismiss them if they're talking about something intelligent. It's, you know, it's all of these cultural stereotypes that, you know, they're not for the good. You know, they do not really improve the overall community of being human. At least that's my personal opinion.
Well, do you feel, is there some, just to get ourselves out of this, Donald Trump K-hole that we've gone down here.
Yeah.
Do you feel like there's some sort of takeaway? Like, I mean, you know, I do feel like maybe what we're getting at here is there's a kind of personal liberation in not getting baited into the outrage over whatever dumb shit Donald Trump said that day.
I agree. There is. And that's a great lesson that people are learning. I think outrage culture on the internet is slowly on the fade. And the only reason it's not quickly on the fade is because there are new people coming into internet culture.
Mm-hmm.
And those new people, it's very easy to get swept up in the outrage culture. Everyone who's been around for a while, you know, coupled with the fact that, you know, if you're part of this tech culture, odds are you're probably, you know, you're a little more affluent. You know, odds are you're a tech person. That means you tend to read more. You probably have a certain degree of empathy. You know, I would even potentially risk saying maybe even a higher level of empathy than some folks. And that means that outrage culture, while it's very psychologically appealing in some ways. It's really appetitive and it's satisfying in the short term. I think that that burns out pretty quickly with most people who are exposed to it and who engage in it.
Mm-hmm.
So that's really on the fade with a lot of these experienced, social media people. And the only reason it's not experiencing a sharp die off is because of new blood in the community. I think people are starting to distinguish themselves with not outrage. Personally, I admire the hell out of Felicia Day for what she does on her own self, as opposed to what she does that is purely a reaction to other people. She doesn't get up and stand on a soapbox and rail against, white dudery and whatever. It's like, she's like, I'm going to do Geek and Sundry. And just, if you haven't noticed, a lot of our hosts and people and the folks that run it and all of the founders are women.
Hmm.
She never made a huge point of that. It was just something she did. And that's how she wanted to make her mark in the world. And I admire the hell out of that. Because, there are some people who, as soon as you say, hey, look what I'm doing, and there's a lot of women, their brain flips a switch and they start spewing hate.
Yeah. So part of me wants to say that maybe almost a charitable interpretation of that is that it's zero sum thinking. It's that people, look at that and they apply some sort of semi-rational thought process to it, where they feel like if there's an opportunity for a woman, it's taken an opportunity away from me, a man, in this scenario. And that is one scenario that I almost feel like is the more hopeful scenario that could be going on. And the one that scares me even more is that it's just blatant sexism, and that this does go along with, there is this sort of one, I guess it's also these two sort of competing theories of technology. And one is the sort of techno-utopian vision of, well, eventually we're going to have this free flow of information and we're all going to be connected and empathy will skyrocket and we're all going to become one, borderless nation of ideas, and we're going to grow together and conflict will dissolve. And there's another vision of technology, which is a little more cynical, which says, well, we are who we are, and technology is just going to let us be that at scale. So whatever we are, if it's petty, misogynist, hateful, exclusionary, whatever, you name the bad characteristic that humans are, scared, hateful, selfish, technology just scales that, right? So it's like, well, now we can be selfish on a much larger scale, on a global scale. Now we can be fearful at scale.
Yeah, I can get both of those. And, the truth is, sexism is very real. There was one person, like I was hanging out, I was playing tack with somebody, and there was a TV playing and there was some political whatever, and we kind of like brushed up against the subject, and this guy said, I kind of expected a conversation similar to what I had on this plane. And it was interesting because the guy on the plane, he was probably, he had 20 years on me, he's maybe 65 or so. And so it was kind of neat for me to see him, still, again, being a Democrat, because traditionally we tend to swing a little conservative as we get older. But also, he was back in the woman. And so when I was playing tack with this guy, I kind of expected to say, oh, I'm Bernie or whatever. And, kind of have a similar accord. And he made just kind of an offhand comment, and and it was something like, I just don't know if I can get behind Hillary. And the comment was, and I can't remember it specifically, mm-hmm. but it was along the lines of, she's kind of just like, like all women.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, what? Like, because it was in reference to like, the big things that are blown up about her, the email thing and this whatever thing.
Is that a stereotype about women, that they run private email servers with classified information. I do hear that. Yeah, you go to the bar and a lot of people are like, man, my wife with the private email server with classified information on it. please email Pat with all your comments about this episode.
Man, women and they servers, they crazy, man. But it was like, and it was one of those real casual, like, just us guys, we get this sort of comments. And I wasn't quite sure if that's what he really meant. And, you know, again, I didn't know this guy really well. And it's really, you know, that's a potential landmine of a conversation, which I'm not afraid of. But I also didn't want to say, like, to stop it and go, excuse me, we need to backtrack and really textually and analyze the statement you made. I'm really, because I don't want to assume that maybe you're kind of got like some deep, dark, sticky, tarry awfulness in you that maybe you're not aware of. Like, that was not the nature. Like, this is the first time we had ever met.
I hate being implicitly drawn into people's casual racism or sexism. Like, when I'm in a car, jumping into a cab and the cab driver tries to tell me a racist joke or something. And he's like, hey, we get it, right? Couple of guys. Like, here's the joke that obviously we both agree with. And it's like I'm at such war with myself because like every Midwestern instinct in my body is like, don't have a fight with this guy, like, you know, it's like, don't have a confrontation.
You know what happened, and this is a different issue, but it's kind of the same thing, where I went to see Civil War. Have you seen it?
I'm gonna make a little note that we need to talk. I'm gonna see it this weekend, and I'll make a little note that we need to talk about the Marvel movies. I've recently watched all the Marvel movies, and I have a lot of thoughts.
Okay, I would love to talk about that. So I'm not going to talk about the movie in particular, although I will say just in a general statement that I very much enjoyed it. I enjoyed it to such an extent that I felt obliged to mention it right now.
This Marvel episode is going to be a barn burner. Maybe the final episode.
Yeah, we successfully navigate politics, sex, and religion, and our our schism, you know, is over like Stark and Captain America. But you know, so I'm in the theater, and it was actually opening night, which I never do, but I'm hanging out with a friend, and we're watching the previews, and there's this preview about like a woman, and there's a shark, and she's on a reef, and I'm looking at it, and I'm like, this is kind of interesting. It's sort of like, you know, it's obviously kind of character centered. It's suspense. Do you know which movie I'm talking about? I don't even know.
I do not.
Because the thing is she's out. She's a surfer. She's capable. She's on this island, this remote tropical island, and then there's a shark attack. And then she's on a reef, but the tide is rising. Mm-hmm. And so like, what do you do? And I'm like, and I'm watching it and I'm like, this is really interesting because, you know, it's like, it's a shark attack movie, but it's not about all like a series of attacks at a beach or they're on a boat and they have guns. This is like very personal. It's very small. It's got to have a lot of tension. And you know, female protagonist, female main character. So I was kind of interested there. And so the trailer finishes and I'm kind of thinking these thoughts and I turn to the woman that I'm with to kind of, you know, to say something like, well, that seems interesting or, you know, it's, you know, female centered shark survival is not something I would have anticipated from Hollywood. And as I'm turning toward her, she turns towards me and goes, nope. just like flat denial of everything. And I'm like, okay. And it made me stop and go, was the fact that this woman was in a bikini through most of the preview enough to stupefy my higher brain functions into thinking maybe this is good? You know, have I just not seen enough movies that I realize that this is a train wreck waiting to happen? But in the context of somebody, like starting to tell you a racist joke or somebody saying, well, you know how women are, crazy bitches, right? Ha ha ha. You know, I kind of like the nope. Is, you know, just kind of it not starting a fight, not saying, hey, let's examine it. I kind of like going, you know, yeah, you know how women are, right? And I'm like, nope.
Well, that's very Socratic, right? It's like, ah, well, you are wise as to Rothfonius. You are wise as to the ways of woman, but I am just a humble idiot. So please enlighten me. Please teach me. Do me the great honor of telling me the nature of women.
Oh, God, yeah.
Socrates was a little bit of a troll.
The title of this episode should be The Nature of Women.
I'll just put a little note in there. Please email Pat. Well, how about this? I think let's end. I think a good sort of way to put a little positive spin on the end of this is, like, what's a thing, what's a little challenge or a thing we can do this week that takes some of these ideas that we're talking about and puts them into play? So, like, one thing, so what I like about the nope answer in the theater, it's interesting because it's not saying, you know, she wasn't like, oh, well, I'm going to have it out with you right here and have a whole debate and go back and forth and one of us is going to win and someone's going to be right and, like, the world will be put at rights, right? It was just like, nah, it's not for me. Like, I don't need to make a whole thing about it, just not interested. And I often wish I could do that with myself. Like, I get very riled up about something, and then I, like, the nearest person has to suffer having me rant about it, or, you know, like, as though it's like this important, like, oh, someone must hear my thoughts on this. And unfortunately, I feel like, especially with this, as the election's been going, like, my Twitter discipline has been very poor. My poor Twitter followers have been kind of the recipient of a lot of my complaining and joking and kind of just honestly just bitching and moaning and ranting and raving about Donald Trump. Is that why
I finally pulled ahead of you in terms of Twitter followers?
It would not surprise me, right? I mean, in all seriousness, it's like Twitter makes me miserable, and I am nauseous when I'm on Twitter, and I check it compulsively, looking for that little dopamine hit of like, did someone, you know, fave my joke or whatever. But it makes me miserable. Overall, its effect on my life is to make me miserable. And I tell myself that I can't just walk away from Twitter and abandon it because I need it for work, right? Like, this is how, when I do something, with my life, I post about it on Twitter, and that's how I get the word out. And I've already sort of abandoned a lot of the other social networks. So I don't know. So it's interesting. Like, I feel like I can't leave Twitter, but I wonder if it would be an interesting challenge for us to think of a way to, you know, using Twitter and the ways that we publicly communicate to, like, not, like, have a week of being conflict adverse. Although it strikes me that you've been very good on Twitter lately.
You know, it's I'm a big fan of choosing my moment. You know, and it's partly what you mentioned, which is like every time we speak his name, he gains power. But the other thing, you know, and I actually learned a much harder lesson last year when the whole Hugo kerfuffle was going on. And, you know, because I was pretty, you know, I was invisibly but intimately attached to that. Because, you know, I am a member of the fantasy community. I do really care about its well-being. But here's the tricky bit, and here was the complicating factor. I strongly suspected that one of the categories that had been hijacked and usurped was a category in which I would have been nominated for an award if they hadn't gone in and kind of engaged in some fuckery. And so I was very aware that anything that I said would be inevitably colored by the fact that, you know, I was a little butthurt that I wasn't going to maybe get a trophy. because the truth is, like, everybody likes getting a trophy. So, you know, I learned – the other thing that I learned then is – everyone in the community was writing a blog and talking about it online and maliciously subtweeting all over the place. And I'm like, you know, let's say I did have something new to say, and I did say it. And people actually found it amid all of these other people talking on the subject. And, you know, and they didn't already agree with me. You know, that's a bunch of big conditionals.
Yeah.
And it's like, what would, you know, it's like, if I could I then write something that might make these people who were aware of the situation and who believed differently than I did, could I actually persuade anyone? And the conditionals always lined up. It's like, given the amount of chatter, given the hotness of the topic, given my own position, that there was kind of, there was such a statistically slender chance of me talking to anyone productively on the subject that I bowed out and I left the talking to, honestly, to much more capable people like Scalzi and Jim Hines. They write much more quickly and much better on those subjects than I do. Or Mary Robnett Kowal, all of whom are just really on top of it. So I feel kind of similarly about politics, where it's so divisive. And you know, it'd be one thing if I was somebody who constantly spoke on the subject, but I'm not. And I'm aware that because of that, a lot of people follow me who are on both sides of the fence. And I feel like what I do is I build up a certain amount of credit with them. They know that I'm hopefully a good person, hopefully a rational person, hopefully a thoughtful and well-informed person. And then when I eventually come to them and say, hey, everybody, you know, I don't like doing this, but I feel like we need to talk about the fact that, you know, there's something potentially bad and uncomfortable going on, and I want to share some thoughts. When I make a post like that, I feel like it burns off some of my accumulated karma. And so I pick those moments very carefully, again, because I view it as a sort of pedagogy, a sort of teaching and a sort of persuasion. And again, not preaching, not even teaching, but informing, like bringing information to people's attention. But some information is just so perilous and so difficult to digest that it's impossible for people to perceive it as anything other than preaching. So, I pick my moments very carefully. Also, I am lazy, and writing things like that is super hard. So I conserve my energy that way. I get to double up in that regard.
Well, I wonder if there's something to this of to come up with like a challenge for ourselves related to this. What have been something to the effect of so we were talking about like reading novels as being opposed, you know, that is building empathy, and getting into, you know, these like back and forth arguments with people on Twitter, how much it makes, you know, it others people and it makes them the enemy and it decreases your empathy. Is there some way where we could like channel our angry Twitter energy into, you know, both, and which is not always writing rants on Twitter, right? Cause I angry read Twitter every morning. I wake up in a panic and I go on Twitter and I'm like, what's everyone mad about today, right? I want to find out what the terrible thing is. Is there some way to channel that low empathy behavior into like reading a book?
I think the simplest way to do that would be to like, you know, here's the thing. Do you think you could take a day off Twitter?
Yeah. I mean, I think I could certainly, you know, what I could do is go to a write only mode to Twitter, where it's like, if I have something to post or announce, like this podcast, for example, I'll just sort of post it and then not stick around and read my timeline and, you know, link people to opposing news articles or whatever I would do otherwise.
Well, that's halfway there, you know, but that's not really no Twitter. That's like saying, I'm only going to shoot up the smack, but I won't rub any on my teeth.
Right. Well, here's the thing, though, is like neither of us can get off of Twitter professionally. Like it would be really bad.
Right, but not for a day.
Oh, well, I could. Sure. Could I cold turkey for a day? In theory, not that I have never done it since I started using Twitter in 2008, but I could stop anytime I want. So here's what I'm thinking. I think I could try a day off of Twitter, although I have a feeling it's going to be going cold turkey like that is going to be difficult. But I'm thinking of something to the effect of take the Twitter app off of my phone, because Twitter is when I'm like, you know, when I'm in an elevator or when I have a minute or, you know, whatever, if I'm in a cab or in the airport, whatever it is, if I have 1 minute, I go on Twitter, right? That's like my quick hit little thing because I can read it quickly. So I'm thinking, what if I take that off of my phone and I kind of put the Kindle app in the place where the Twitter app used to be, because I have my little muscle memory that immediately like turn my phone on and hit the Twitter icon before I even know what's happening.
Yep.
And what if that opens up the Kindle app instead?
I like that. I think that's a great thing, especially, and this is something I was talking with Ryan Wheaton about when I was out in LA. He said that's a big it, and I mentioned this because it ties in very closely to one of the things we talked about in the last season of the podcast, whereas like we're not going to wake up and immediately get onto our phones. He actually took it a step broader than that, where he's like, you know, he did a bunch of research. And so he's like, I get up in the morning, I eat some food, I go outside, you know, I look at, you know, I kind of look at the world. He goes, I start my day slow and I give my brain the opportunity to acclimate to the real world. And he goes, and it has a huge impact on your thought processes throughout the day, as well as your perception of time. Where I don't know about you, but like I get up and I'm like, okay, I better do this thing. I better check my email. And if I start the day checking email, I'll have a great email day, but I'll do nothing else. And, you know, and what he said made a lot of sense about if you get your brain started in the real world, later you can dip into this other world. But, you know, what he mentioned that sounded super appealing to me is the fact that your perception of time actually isn't tied to the fast-paced serotonin bump nature of the internet. And so it actually feels like you have a lot more time because your brain is functioning in a different way. So I think, pulling the Twitter app off your phone, if nothing else, it will help you avoid that in the morning. That's something that I'm trying to do, is to wake up in the morning, like eat some breakfast, spend some time alone with my thoughts, look at the world, and have a little peace in the morning and have that be my baseline for the day, as opposed to, you know, hell, even email is a better start to the day than Twitter.
Well, should we try our little app switch and report back next week?
I have never, ever, ever read an ebook.
Oh, interesting.
And I don't have the Kindle app. I'm wondering what I could replace it with.
Well, I got a couple ideas. Do you do you could do magazines? Like, I don't know if you do like the Atlantic or the New Yorker or whatever. Sometimes I'll have that on my phone if I'm traveling. Or there's also really good apps like Longform or Instapaper that where you can just like have. So do you know about Instapaper?
No.
This might be a good one for you. So Instapaper is like time-synced reading. It's like one of the number one essential apps. It's like one of the first apps I put on any new phone I get, and I live on this thing. So when someone sends me an article to read, or I'm on Twitter and someone links to something, I try to get myself out of the habit of immediately reading it, because I don't want to have my day constantly interrupted by stopping to read whatever comes in front of me, right?
Right.
So Instapaper, it goes on your computer, and it's this little bookmarklet that goes in your bookmarks bar, and when you come to an article that you want to read later, you click on this link that says read later, and Instapaper sends its little robot to the website. The robot goes to the website, takes just the text, none of the ads, none of the bullshit or the pull quotes or any of that. It just takes the text. It puts the text in your Instapaper account. It syncs to your phone. And then the next time you turn your phone on, you have just the text of the article waiting for you, ready to go, downloaded on your phone in a very readable format. Wow. So it takes all of the like instant interruption of these like articles, and it puts them way more in your control. And you know what's fun is, because you are picking everything that goes in your Instapaper, all the stuff in your Instapaper queue is great because you picked it. It's like this really, you open it up and you're like, ooh, I'm excited to read everything in here.
That's cool. Like, drop me a line to that.
Here's what I'll do is I have a couple of links I'll put these in the show notes and I'll send this to you. So it's Instapaper is the name of the app that I like. There's some competitors, but I don't like them as much. And I use a service called Pinboard that's like a bookmark service. And you can use Pinboard in a lot of different ways, but the way I use it is when I read something really good on my Instapaper, like the best of the best of the best, I put it on my Pinboard. And I maybe have a couple dozen articles there that I would say are like the best sort of articles I've ever read.
Oh, cool.
And for yourself or for any listeners who are like just looking for a few good things to throw in that Instapaper app, I will humbly submit my Pinboard collection.
That'd be cool. And I would love to have something like that I could show off to people.
All right. So... Pat, we'll talk the same time next week, and I have my little list of topics for this year, so if people want to stick with us for the next run of episodes, I have down here that we have to talk about all of the Marvel Cinematic Universe, and I may need you to mansplain some of that to me, because I'm not sure I fully understand what I've seen. I am very interested to get sort of the insider update on all of your LA adventures and what's happening with the film and TV and all these crazy media projects happening are on the books, and I will ring you like a bar rag and get all the details out of you. I'm sure our listeners from the last run are fascinated to get the updates on our land, if we're going to get some land, and
oh, yeah.
What's happening with our various survival bunkers, and Veronica and I got a house here in Chicago, so we can I'm happy to share a little bit of the details about that. Let's see, we have to have it out about this stupid baby language that you were trying to tell me about. What's that thing called?
Oh yeah, yeah. We'll totally duke that out.
I would love to be convinced, but it sounds like sounds like total nonsense to me. We'll do our nutrition episode, and I think it might be fun to have a guest on who actually knows something about nutrition to come and give us some advice on that. That's something I'm actually actively trying to improve in my life as well. And finally, I have down here that Pat will reveal major spoilers for the third book in the Name of the Wind series, Doors of Stone, and the final episode. So stick with us until the end, and there will be major textual spoilers for the third book.
Absolutely. As a matter of fact, there will be subtle spoilers scattered throughout every episode. So you need to actually listen to the entire episode to catch these and then compile them in a meaningful way. You might need to listen to each episode more than once just to find them all.
Pat, I don't want to blow your cover here, but would it be safe to say that our listeners are trying to detect some sort of code or anagrams possibly in the things that we're talking about? These carefully orchestrated conversations where we would be signaling, perhaps using acronyms and taking the first letter of every sentence and so on and so forth.
I think that people would not be out of line to perhaps notice if I place a different emphasis on a different syllable occasionally and then be able to string those together in meaningful ways. I do tend to embed a lot of secrets in my text, and that's not just the physical text, it's also my verbal text. Yes. God, we just destroyed some son of a bitch's life, you realize. He's going to transcribe the whole thing, and he's going to have like some serious, like a memento series of fucking journals. He's going to tattoo this shit on his body.